How should we think about the legacy of C.S. Lewis? My name is Matthew Lee Anderson, and you are listening to one more episode of Mere Fidelity, the podcast where we think together about the Word of God and the world we live in. This episode is brought to you by our friends at LexinPress. You can get all the LexinPress Mere Fidelity books of the month at lexinpress.com/merefidelity. You can get 40% off the February book of the month, The 10 Commandments for All God's Children. You can believe it. It's a book for all God's children, for both parents and those parents' children, both of whom are God's children. 10 Commandments, Harold Sinkbeil, who did a lovely episode with us on his book, The Care of Souls, has done the text for this. Natasha Kennedy has done the art. It's beautiful. Do get a copy, 40% off, lexinpress.com/merefidelity. And shout out to the Merry Band as well. If you want to join the Merry Band, do so at merefidelity.com. Thanks for keeping our spirits lifted and our coffers a little bit more full than they would be otherwise. All right, guys, Alistair is with me. Derek is with me. Guys, it's good to be with you. Andrew's off running around doing what Andrew does. We thought we would take up C.S. Lewis as a way into thinking about maybe the differences between British and American evangelicalism, which showed up a little bit in our conversation about weddings and what weddings we can go to and that whole kerfuffle. We've talked about the differences between British and American evangelicalism before, had a great conversation about it. I think one of our better ones, which is saying something. I think all of our conversations, guys, are fantastic. But we did have talked about this before, but C.S. Lewis is a peculiar person in the relationship between the Brits and the Americans. And as we are a podcast, one of the few podcasts that claims both His Majesty the King's realm and the free states of the United States of America, members of both, I think this is a ready-made subject for us to talk about. Alistair, you have been thinking a lot about Lewis because you're probably, by the time this is posted, have written, we don't know how much, probably 10,000, maybe 50,000 words of a newsletter about C.S. Lewis. I'm curious, can you distill, for those of us who are not going to read all 10,000 words, what your take is on C.S. Lewis and his legacy within British evangelicalism versus American evangelicalism?
Well, I think there are a few other things to note. Certainly on our credentials front, we're named Mere Fidelity, which is, among other things, a hat tip to C.S. Lewis. We're associated with Mere Orthodoxy as well. And a certain one of our members has lived in C.S. Lewis's house for an extensive period of time.
I was going to hold that back. This is a fact about my bio that not many people know. But yeah, I have lived in the kilns. That's true.
For me, the discussion is interesting because there were a number of different threads that came together. And first of all, it was a tweet by Kat Coffin, who's a progressive C.S. Lewis scholar on Lewis and on gender studies, and predictably sort of progressive and favorable towards deconstruction, these sorts of things. And she was tweeting about the number of people who have taken that route, who have been very appreciative of Lewis, and for whom Lewis has played an important part in that transition. And that was curious to me. I was also interested by the way that the British evangelicalism, American fundamentalism, opposition came up later on in the conversation surrounding Alistair Begg, when I had already been thinking about it in the context of thinking about C.S. Lewis and tweeting about that. And then Mark Knoll came out with a piece in Advantes just a few days ago, which talks about the reception of Lewis earlier, his earlier works within America. And so it was this confluence of different areas of conversation. The widespread influence of Lewis, his appreciation among a wide selection of different constituencies that aren't usually brought together in the appreciation of anyone, that stood out to me. And so I started off on that thread thinking about, why is it that so many people like Lewis? He's appreciated by adults and children. He's appreciated by Christians and non-Christians. He's appreciated by people on the left and right, liberals and conservatives, by people all over the world. and of people for the better part of a century. And so that ability to speak to such a wide range of different groups is noteworthy, especially in a context where we increasingly find that our voices are siloed, they're speaking to a very narrow constituency, there is a sort of ideological flavor, there's a combativeness, etc. Now, why is it that Lewis was able to exceed that? The other thing that's been interesting to me is the number of people for whom Lewis, in various directions, has played an important part in transitions, in their movement to the Christian faith. That's an important part of Susanna's story, for instance. The importance of Lewis in people's movement towards different expressions of Christianity, into the ways and into deconstruction for some people. And so why is it that Lewis plays this role that seems very distinctive? And so that provoked for me a line of thought that led me to reflect upon Lewis's context, that Lewis was working at an intersection between worlds. He was within the academy, he was writing as a Christian scholar, but also as someone who was primarily doing academic work within a context of public conversation that was more extensive than just a Christian constituency. Also, the context of the Church of England that he was part of, where, for instance, he emphasizes, as a fairly reluctant churchgoer, the experience of just having to worship with people with whom he did not have a great deal in common, or the experience of worshipping in a church where he didn't always agree with the priest. That experience, I think, is maybe more of a shaping one for Lewis and his work than we give it credit. And so I was reflecting upon the fact that there are conditions that lead to the growth of someone like Lewis that can't be replicated very easily elsewhere. It requires a certain degree of establishment. It requires the sort of parochial tendency to meet with consistently people who are not like you and to learn to cross some of those boundaries. And yeah, that can start us off at least, but it seems an interesting contrast between the distinctive form of Church of England religion that he represented and the sort of American fundamentalism that has so often seen so much to appreciate in him.
Start us off, finish it, you know, that seems like the whole ball of wax right there, Alistair, the beginning and the end.
The thing about Lewis, so I think one of the reasons that he can appeal so broadly is, there's the universality of his particularness. He's quintessentially, you know, you think about an English Oxford Don. All right, this is what you're getting, like with Lewis. You read him, you hear him, he's, you know, he's writing about pubs, he's thinking about, there's no confusing who he is, where he's from, all that sort of thing. But it's one of the things that Noel points out in his Advantes piece. I think he's referencing one of the early reviews of him in the American context. What he studied classics and what he taught, Lewis was deeply convinced of the universality of human nature and the universality of the human experience in all of its fullness and its range across times and cultures and places, which lends a range to his thought and a focus of his thought on the universality of the Christian faith. The universality of the Christian faith, the mere Christianity that he really relentlessly focused on and was not easily distracted from, as it were, spoke to the universality of human needs, human experiences, human heartache, human loss, human curiosity, human questions, human constitution, nature. He had a very rich theology of human nature and the natural that needed redemption. And so because he had that kept him from being boxed in ways that might box a good writer. Like his ability to communicate at a range literarily is just distinctive. All of these things, the universality and the particularity of who he is, I think is kind of the big entry point in terms of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's something about his own spiritual life that is also extremely eclectic, right? Because he does have this deep training and formation in classics. From the time he's a boy, he's you know, doing a sort of standard English boys' school type of thing. But then once he converts, you know, he goes to he's Anglican, of course, but he's working on English literature in the 16th century, excluding drama, and starts reading these Puritans. And, you know, Mere Christianity is a book that has Richard Baxter as, you know, like behind it somewhere. And so he's got this sort of spirituality that is deeply resonant in many ways with an American evangelicalism that has its own connection to Puritans, sort of several, you know, generations down, but there's sort of these sort of tendencies that come from that stream of Christianity that are present very much in Lewis's thought, but it's married to this philosophical sense and this sort of training in classics and whatnot that gives it a kind of sophistication that American evangelicals just didn't produce at the time and have not produced since, because they don't have the full formation that he had, the deep well of learning that he was drawing from. And that I think makes him a lot more pliable or flexible as a thinker and makes him very hard to pigeonhole. He's not a standard high church C of E person. And part of that is too, while he's an Oxford don and while he's hanging out in Oxford and has his rooms in Magdalen and whatnot, he's spending time, most of his time, weekends and whatnot, out at the Kilns, his house, which is a very working class environment. His brother, Warney, was in the army. Mrs. Moore, the woman that he probably had an affair with prior to the time of him being a Christian, was very working class. Paxton, the gardener, was around. He was surrounded. The whole household was surrounded by these working class individuals who he got to know. And so while he was, you can't imagine him just being the sort of Oxford don who becomes very detached from ordinary concerns. His time at the Kilns really enmeshed him in really domestic, like really robust domestic life with working class people that expanded, I think, his horizons, or at least kept his horizons expanded in a way in which is very hard for academics to have. So I think that those sorts of background features of his life give him a sort of pliability. Here's one thing I want to know, Alistair, Derek, in terms of thinking about how people have read Lewis and responded to Lewis. I was likewise fascinated by the many deconstructors who cited Lewis as key figures in their movements away from traditional Christianity. And what I want to know is that because they're just not reading him closely? Or what am I missing? Because when I read Lewis, maybe it's because I don't have many anxieties that certain very fundamentalist type evangelicals in America have from their youth. I have never felt some of those anxieties. But when I read Lewis, I find very little that would make me think, oh, I need to actually move away from the Mere Christianity and the, right, which is a book that is, like, in terms of gender norms, been accused for being extremely regressive, right? It's very hard to read Mere Christianity and think, oh yeah, this guy is a egalitarian feminist, right? Like, that's not the takeaway from some of his stuff on marriage. And the Space Trilogy, certainly, right? That Hideous Strength is just, it's not that. So I just wonder, like, when all those people are citing that, I think, like, what did they read here that did that? Is this about him or them?
As someone who's been on both sides of that to some degree, you know, I started encountering Lewis in college, like as one does as an evangelical church kid. And
I did it in middle school, Derek. So I don't know.
That's fine. I wasn't a nerd. It was a different kind. But I started reading him then, and it was when I started getting into theology some, and there's a way of encountering him where he is the presenter of Mere Christianity, right? That's the first book that often you're handed. He's the presenter of Mere Christianity. And then you go on to find out that there's all these weird, quirky things that to an evangelical kid who has, like, there's a box of stuff that good, mere Orthodox people believe. And then you find out that Lewis is weird on those things. So you read Mere Christianity, and then his presentation on the atonement in that book, that doesn't quite sound like the, you know, I couldn't have said the word penal substitution, but that's not it, right? It's actually I don't know, some blend of McLeod Campbell and P.T. Forsyth and whatever, Perfect Penitent. You don't know that at the time, but yeah, so you got that. And then you come to find out, oh, problem of pain. There's this weird, oh, he affirms evolution and there's a historical fall, but not a fall. And then you find out about his views on inerrancy and scripture and all. And so there's a way in which there's a lot of piecemeal little positions that he has, and they're not little, but they're things that are often, as Matt was, you know, the word that Matt was fond of last episode, shibboleths in American evangelicalism.
That was your word.
That was my word.
That was your word.
It was my word.
We'll blame Alistair. It was not my word.
I was fond of defending it.
Too many syllables for me.
Yeah, there you go. And you find out that Lewis violates a whole bunch of them. And yeah. Because he's not an American evangelical. He wasn't in the fundamentalist modernist controversies. And so there's a sense in which there are a lot of positions that seem transgressive and seem boundary moving for you in your position, in your conservative evangelicalism that you're raised in. And so all of a sudden you have permission to think in some ways that orthodoxy might encompass these kinds of positions. And so Lewis is your gateway into thinking of Christians who mm-hmm. hold these views that you were told that Christians can't hold, but he very obviously does and very obviously loves Jesus. And the people who told you can't hold those positions handed you this book. And so there's this weird kind of thing, which I think leads people to then read Lewis against the grain of Lewis's basic instinct and basic movement and basic position, mm-hmm. which is that of, he's fundamentally conservative in a lot of ways, and he's fundamentally not there to transgress conservative norms, to edgily push, fundamentalism, to edgily aggrieve, your youth pastor or anybody, you know, whoever it is that is the person in your head that stands in for all of evangelicalism. Lewis is there fundamentally talking to skeptics, mm-hmm. to people struggling, to people who have they're so far beyond anything that you are even edging towards yet. He's trying to pull them back. So his concessions and his thoughts are those of somebody moving, you know, from left to right, not right to left, and as it were, you know, use the scale as you want. And so, you know, that's I think part of what happens. And then, you know, when I did this, I was in a position, I was reading this during the emergent stuff, and I was starting to read theology when the emergent church thing was still a conversation. And so it's, oh, well, maybe inerrancy, maybe not. And I was actually starting to shift a lot of things. Now, I ended up coming back more conservative in a lot of ways, most ways, but early on, you see how it can kind of take you out. And then it's only as you keep reading him and mm-hmm. keep the deep vein of his thought that he kind of brings you back around again. But I think encountering those piecemeal positions as someone who's already in a small little world that hasn't encountered the wider world, that he becomes a gateway instead of somebody who's in one of those places and then reads them and it's like, oh my gosh, this guy's fundamentally just a, you know, conservative and like, oh my gosh, how could he believe all this stuff? So that's, I think, how that happens.
I think to add to that, I think that's all right, and very strong. I think that's very much how to explain it. I think Lewis is really so different from a fundamentalist. He's just not got the character of a fundamentalist in being very sectarian, in defining himself very much over against, in a series of conflicts with modernism, with progressivism, etc. He has those strong convictions against some of these positions, but he's not been defined by that sort of sectarianism. He's part of the Church of England. He's having to learn to express the faith in a way that it's mere Christianity. It's playing towards those things that are common to Christians of true faith and majoring on those things, not upon those things that make my particular denomination or sect distinctive. And so that whole instinct is not one that is often shared by fundamentalists who are encountering Lewis's work. I think there's also the fact that he is someone who is engaging with sort of cultural background that, the more you discover it, is very different from the sort of fundamentalist culture that many of the kids who are first encountering him have grown up with. He's drinking, he's smoking, he's someone who is part of a context of academia and very confident and at home within that world. He's not afraid of threatening ideas in the ways that they've been taught to be. And so encountering Lewis within that world, he is a breath of fresh air that leads you out of that cave. And it's certainly something that I've always appreciated about Lewis. My background was one with a lot more openness to ideas, but there were people further away from my immediate family who were very closed, and it was very difficult to expand your horizons. But Lewis represents for that the possibility, among other things, and this is where it need not move in the direction of progressivism, the possibility that the same convictions can be held in a very different way, that they can be inhabited in a form that's far more life-affirming, far less divisive, far more Catholic, with a small c, and far more universal. Point that Derek made earlier about the universality of Lewis's thought, I think, is incredibly important. He's speaking with confidence about nature. It's not the same sort of ideological tendency that many people have. It's not a dogmatism. There's a confidence that you can speak about reality itself and find an answering resonance within people's hearts. And that confidence, I think, the confidence of true myth and the idea that there is something about the Christian message itself that resonates with universal themes that you find in various cultures expressed differently, or the ethics of the Tao that he talks about at the conclusion of the abolition of man. All of these things are instances, I think, of a confidence in a culture of persuasion, of a pacific spirit that you can go out and you can speak to people winsomely, dare I say, and speak to them in a way that expects, because they are human beings, that there will be some echo of the Christian message as you speak it to them in a way that is truthful and candid and yet loving and positive. Also, it's his form of apologetics is not the sort of more antagonistic form that you might find in presuppositional apologetics, although he does make those moves sometimes. But it's a confidence that we share a reality, and that if you're reading the Greeks, if you're reading other pagan myths, they're dealing with that reality too. And I think that gives you a whole posture towards reality, along with the Catholic and Irenic spirit of someone who's part of a church that's seeking to find common ground. That just gives a way of dealing that I think is very powerful for those who have grown up in contexts shaped by distinctives and divisions and departures from other groups and antagonisms with them.
Something related here is Lewis's, the universality of his sense of sin feels understated. And that seems like something not to emphasize, but Lewis, I think, is one of the best and most persuasive and most subtle, in a sense, preachers of sin that the modern world has produced. There is almost nobody I know who, when you read him in his ethical section in the Mere Christianity and others, just understands the psychology of getting you to understand how all the shabby little things that you hide from yourself. And he has a way of cozying up alongside of you, getting into your head, because you know he's talking about what's in his own head in a lot of ways.
Okay, so, Letters is a great example of that.
Yes, but like he has a way of getting into your psychology, because as a fellow sinner who said, come now, let's be reasonable. We both know what we're like when that very subtle, very humble, very realistic understanding of the universality of sin across times and cultures and places and people is also kind of like this interstitial space between his universal sense of nature and his sense of the universality of redemption, right? And they're all together, right? The universality of nature and natural law arguments fits with his universal sense that you need what the gospel is offering, as well as his ability to get into your head and your heart to get you, come on, let's quit lying to ourselves, right? But he has a way of doing it that's not arm twisty, manipulative, psychologically like abusive, whatever. It's just, hey, let's be real. Let's understand. We both need this. And it's so subtle that his, even his way of embracing, universal sinfulness, it's funny. He's criticized total depravity. I think he actually misunderstood the doctrine of total depravity, because he's actually one of the greatest articulators of the complete and total need and extensiveness and internal sense of sin. And I think that's one of the things that actually connects across with everybody in a powerful way.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. Alistair, I was thinking about your description of Lewis and his apologetics, and I think there's a lot of truth to the way in which you frame it. He does seem to move away from that kind of direct apologetic appeal at the end of his life. It's, you know, Mere Christianity is written under the shadow of the World War. The abolition of man is the same. You know, That Hideous Strength, which is a very explicitly kind of apologetic type of novel, is published in 1945. And that really comes close to the end of his work. Miracles is published 1947. He revises it in 1960. But he doesn't spend very much time after the war doing direct apologetic stuff. What he does is he writes a lot of fiction. So you get The Chronicles of Narnia, you get Till We Have Faces, and you get his Surprised by Joy. Like, he's doing an alternate mode of engagement. And I was thinking about the confidence level that he has. And the reasons for his confidence level. This is one thing where I think actually N.T. Wright, his critique of Mere Christianity has some weight, right? Like, the confidence level that he has in the midst of a war is entirely warranted. It's really easy for people to hear the arguments that he lays out for instance, a universal good and a universal an objective evil in Mere Christianity and think, this has to be right. Bombs are dropping on us from Nazis, right? Like, that's it's going to resonate very, very deeply. Once that stops, and once the contest between these forces or these powers becomes more invisible, it's a lot harder for those sorts of arguments to resonate directly with people. And I think there's a sense in which Lewis tries to still do the same sort of project, but in a mode that is sidestepping the explicit appeal that is trying to get into people's intuitions through fiction, through narratives, through these other sorts of approaches. Because I don't know that he has quite as much confidence in the direct appeal as he had in the midst of the war. And some of that, I wonder about the extent to which, you know, Lewis loses the arguments. Right, he writes That Hideous Strength and The Abolition of Man. And That Hideous Strength, I find this fascinating. You know, there's a story among people who are Lewis fans about how badly he was treated by Magdalen College, Oxford. You know, they didn't give him a chair when he was up for it. So he went over to Cambridge, and Cambridge gave him a chair. And so he traveled from, near the end of his life, he traveled from Oxford over to Cambridge, where he had his teaching and research duties. And I think, yeah, that was, like, he probably deserved a chair. But he had also written a novel in which the college fellows, a vast majority of them, were on pretty explicitly on the side of Satan. And in a small, tight-knit community like an Oxford senior common room, that's just not going to go down well. You know, like, you can say this is entirely fictional, and everyone who reads it in Magdalen College thinks, is this me? Does Lewis think this of me? So there's a way in which, you know, I think it cost him. I don't know that's the case, but you could, like, I think it's a very reasonable response to that book if you're a member of Magdalen College. But there's ways in which I think his direct appeal was very time bound. And you get the sense that maybe he lost that argument inside of Magdalen and inside of Oxford. And certainly if you look at the architecture that Oxford uses for its buildings in the 50s and 60s and 70s, Lewis very clearly loses in the university, right? Like, none of the arguments that he makes have any purchase at all. And Oxford puts up these horrendously ugly, brutally modernist buildings that are just absolutely atrocious. They're everything that Lewis was opposed to in many ways.
So I think there's a question of, like, losing or, I mean, he made the arguments. They're still there. And there's a question of just internally moving on. to a different kind of art. Like I wrote Miracles. I don't need to rewrite it. I wrote Mere Christianity. I don't need to keep making that argument. We can still talk about it. It's there. It's in print. You can have an internal sense of growth of like, let me make the point in another way. Because there's also within Narnia, right? There's some of those arguments pop up again, right? So they're just coming in a different form. I do think the post-war context is real in recognizing like, hey, I have to shift tack here, but I don't know if it's like I don't think it's a fundamental loss of confidence in that kind of argument, because even in like Narnia or places like that, there's dialogue about fundamental confidence in like reasoning it out, thinking it through.
Yeah.
You know, I think about the nephews coming, is it Magician's nephew? Professor, was it Diggory? Who's the professor in the Magician's nephew? I'm blanking.
Uncandro, is it? Are you thinking of the?
Yeah. And so they have that dialogue there, and he's kind of bopping on Nietzsche and having arguments about like, just reason it out, think it through logically, et cetera. And so the same basic architecture of thought, I think, present in the novels. And so it's a representation of the same arguments under a different form and aspect.
I mean, you can often point to specific claims or specific passages that are very clearly paralleled within his other work. And also, he may not have been successful in Oxford, but there are still people converting through reading Mere Christianity in the current day, and there are many people who can testify to that. So he may have lost in that particular context of a very small group of people who have reasons career-wise to maybe resent him or whatever. When it comes to
not just career-wise.
Yes.
I'm gonna give them their due. If I wrote a novel about a podcast where my fellow podcast hosts ended up being on the side of Satan, you'd have reasons to resent me that didn't have anything to do with your careers. So just bear that in mind.
No, we'd know you're referring to Andrew. He's the wayward one.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So here's what I want to know with respect to reading. So we talked about a progressive reading of Lewis. But I'm interested in the conservative reading of Lewis in the States. There's been an effort to conscript certain things that Lewis has said into something like the American culture war. I have my own opinions about this effort. It seems
you
like...
You do, Matt? You surprise me.
Yeah. Shocking. Shocking. It's not entirely wrong to me, it seems to me, right? Like Lewis has, again, That Hideous Strength is a book where he's very clear that the universe seems like it's drawing to a point, essentially, where things are getting more clear through time, is the line. And it's obviously it's set in England during Lewis's time, but it's a romance. And it ends in such a way that it's very clear this is not directly equivalent to this world. So whether or not Lewis has a view of history that regards it as sort of inevitable decline, I think for me is an open question. But it does seem like there is a kind of flattening out of Lewis that happens when we import even those frameworks into our own context and extract certain bits that he will say to score our points. Like we lose the sort of multi-textured account of Lewis, who was very, while himself being classically oriented, was in many respects a modernist. Like he's deeply modern, I think, in his approach to thinking in the world. At the end of The Discarded Image, for instance, he has an approach to models that he describes that I think is deeply modernist, where he's basically like, nature's going to give you evidence based on your questions. And that evidence will be real, but your questions are also going to motivate you to see certain evidence. And that's not necessarily bad. It's not necessarily a classical account of how we relate to reality in there. It feels very modern. There's other moments in Lewis too, where I think he's not He's not a reactionary who thinks that we can bring back the Middle Ages. He makes that very, very clear. That's not what he's about. But it's, I think that that side of Lewis gets lost if we take one book like That Hideous Strength or what he does in The Abolition of Man and extract it from the broader framework of his thought. So there's my concern with how I would read Lewis.
One of the things that I was trying to emphasize in my treatment of Lewis was that Lewis has a world within which he makes sense. And that world, in large part, is one that's shaped by the context of the Church of England, where you have local parishes, where you have to be around people with whom you differ. You have a wider established church, which has a place and a voice in public life and a responsibility to speak responsibly into that realm. It has a place within the academy. There are theology departments, and there's an association of the church and the realm of scholarship at the very highest level. There is a context within which different sections of the church, different theological and spiritual temperaments have to be held together. You have to search for common ground and listen charitably to each other. There is a concern also for how to deal with the threat of modernism without simply quarantining yourself off from it, which was in many ways what happened in America. You have the subaltern counterpublics that Alan Jacobs has referred to. That tended to be a context into which evangelicals and fundamentalists retreated. And the mainline, with its sense of responsibility to the wider culture, its sense of the academic and the social elite, that part of society just went its own way. And so Lewis is not splitting to the fundamentalist side against the modernists. He's also engaging with an eclectic range of sources that you don't usually find in these other contexts. And so if you take him outside of that world, it's very easy to take elements of his thought and take them in this sectarian, more culture war way, without recognizing that he's trying to find a way to navigate through these challenges in a way that holds together the body of the faithful within the Church of England, that finds a way to live with his neighbor who has a very different temperament, very different politics, whatever, within a local parish, that finds a way to keep the church as a serious, intellectual, responsible voice at the highest level of the British Academy, and also to find a way to enable the church to fulfill its duty, which is that of a chaplain in many ways within British society, which is not something that fundamentalists have tended to be. And so all of these things push against the culture war emphasis that would be more characteristic of a fundamentalist appropriation of Lewis. That does not mean that Lewis disagrees with them principially, but there is a different way of inhabiting those truths and trying to communicate them. His concern is a far more pacific one, as it were.
So you guys are going to make me put on my American fundamentalist hat again for this episode. The question then arises, two or three points. One, Lewis is, I think, an excellent model in a million different ways, and we should be looking to him, not just particular arguments piecemeal, but seeing how it all fits together. That said, Lewis is not scripture, right? So there is a sense in
whoa,
which-
Whoa.
I know, right? St. Clive, as one of my seminary professors called him, St. Clive, you know, you actually can retrieve bits and leave other bits. It's possible. I do that with, I think most of us do that with his natural law stuff, and we leave to the side some of his comments on the Psalms and that kind of thing. So we all do that to some degree or others, and consciously or consciously. That's part of having subordinate authorities under scripture, which is the only source that you're not supposed to do that with. The other point is, though, is thinking about that. Like, so he did all this stuff in his own context, but the question is, where has he had the greatest effect is potentially in the American context of actually evangelical churches, Roman Catholic spaces, places like that. Like, the mainline is, I'm sorry, but the mainline is dead. It's dying. It's on its last legs. It's the people who in our nation tried to maintain the position of chaplaincy. Much as the Church of England is in England, kind of, it's dying, like in a lot of ways, in terms of who shows up and how it functions, whether it has an actual prophetic voice that speaks and is heard and is taken seriously, or whether it's going to cave in order just to have the seat at the table. And so the people who actually do have some robust force in society, not just in society as a political constituency, but in terms of its ability to retain its children, to convert, to evangelize, all those sorts of things, are those who have, in a sense, learned to deploy Lewis and at what in ways that are maybe a little against the grain, or maybe not quite in his mode. And so there's a sense in which, like, you know, what Lewis might be best for in some ways is being a leavening effect, being an enriching agent, a softening agent, an expanding agent within a context that is different than the one that he was trying to work in. You know, there's a sense in which, like, you know, hey, he lost the argument at Oxford, but he's winning elsewhere, right? I think of a interview recently. Molly Worthen, historian, came to the faith in the last year or two. One thing she cites in her essay, her interview with Colin Hanson over in Gospel Bound, was actually the Hideous Strength trilogy. She talks about the sci-fi trilogy, and like that thing's still packing a punch, but didn't pack a punch where it was. It had to be, it's like it works elsewhere, as it were. And so that's my like semi-defense of like all that's true. And I hope the Lewis vibe leavens and is it's important to have as a model. And at the same time, it is okay to, in a sense, culturally appropriate Lewis for the fundamentalist context and retrieve him.
I would say, first of all, it's important to understand what we mean by fundamentalists. I think fundamentalists is different from conservative evangelical, and that's a point that's been made by many. And one of the things that you think you find with Lewis is that when Lewis and other thinkers influenced the US, and it's important to notice just how influential Lewis and other thinkers that share that sort of temperament that's been forged very much within that British context, the degree to which their reception in the US has enabled that temperament to shape the US too, and enabled guys like Tim Keller would not make sense without a large context where people have learnt from Lewis, been leavened by Lewis's approach. Now, within the UK, I'd also say, don't just dismiss the Church of England or the mainline. There are clearly deep problems. But when you're dealing with, I mean, it's like, it's very easy when you're focusing upon Elijah outside of the system, speaking prophetically against it. It's very easy to miss the possibility that there are, as we know, many faithful prophets, and there are priests within the system who are trying to be faithful and work within a far more complex environment. It's very easy as a sort of sectarian and separatist move to have that sense of prophetic purity and lose the ability to speak faithfully and act faithfully in far more complex environments, where I think many of us have been shaped by that in those environments positively. And I think it's harder to see what's going on from without. There are many faithful evangelicals in the Church of England.
To bring back a point that I made earlier about Lewis's own way in which he approaches this, he is inside of Magdalen College and sees things happening, and then decides to write a novel about the spirit of the age that implicates the people that he is spending time in the SCR with. And so that, like, in terms of prophetic denunciation, that really cost Lewis. I'm really convinced that inside of Oxford, that book was really a bomb because it's so on point. But you get this sense of like he doesn't hold back even in that sort of context. And in that respect, the appropriation of him as a kind of culture warrior feels like it has a little bit more weight to it. Except in this respect, which is Lewis is doing it, writing this thing broadly in a context where he knows he's got to know it's going to cost him very much personally. And it's not clear to me that in the social media signposting or signaling that we do, that that's actually the stakes, that usually there are benefits that are attached to us making those sorts of claims and sort of planting our flags at various places, even if we're alienating lots of people on the other side. Usually we're not alienating people on the other side. They're just not listening to us and we're not listening to them. And so there's no real cost to anyone by virtue of taking these sorts of stances.
And in Lewis's context, it's just not a tribal thing in the same way as it is within current context. When he speaks, he's really costing himself. He's doing something that will lead to significant pushback and to the loss of standing within among his peers. And that is, I think, a great example of how to be neither the sectarian version of fundamentalism, nor the sort of cozying up version who's just the person who's wanting a seat at the table and will do anything to accommodate and be nice and respectable. This is someone who's able to be part of that larger world, to be someone within that bigger pool, not just going off to his own pool and taking the ball home. He's someone who's being part of that wider conversation, prepared to hurt himself when he needs to say something candidly, and yet also respecting the work of the academy, respecting the wider life of the Church of England and the importance of being around people with whom he disagrees. All of this, I think, is something that people in the UK, people in the US can learn from and have learned from.
Yeah,
I think that's absolutely right. The humility, Lewis's words and wounds are those of a friend. I really do mean what we said earlier about his humble sidling up to you. His prophecy is oftentimes self-inclusive and self-condemnatory, because when he writes about Mark in that he is strength, like the academic who's torn and giving and whatever, you have this sense that it's not contemptuous. Like, even if he's writing about contemptible things, he includes himself within the struggles and the challenges and the temptations of the world that he is calling to repentance. And that, I think, is different in that when you're calling people to repentance, you're taking a bold stand. You're doing it in a way that isn't fundamentally us versus them, even though there is an us versus them element in that if you're in Christ and not in Christ, but you're recognizing yourself as someone who has not been and has still some of that same world within you, pulling you.
St. Anne's is an ark, not a battleship.
Yeah. Right, right. And so that fundamental sense is rooted in that universality about nature, universality of the sin, and then the universality of the need for grace, including your own. And that's what keeps, in a sense, separation from being separatism. And it actually marks it out as holiness, is that fundamental humility and recognition of the gospel that is central. And so I think that's a core element of Lewis's legacy that we need to hang on to.
Well, there's a lot more that we could say, but that is a fine last word, Derek, that we have to end on, unfortunately. Guys, this has been an illuminating conversation for me. I've certainly enjoyed it. And we didn't even talk about my time in the kilns. I will save those stories.
You could maybe add an extra word on the kilns.
We should do a plus one, Matt on the kilns, for the Patreon supporters, the merry band of Mere Fidelity listeners. Maybe we'll do that. That'll be fun.
What was Lewis's bathroom look like? There you go.
Well,
everyone wants to know.
Inquiring minds want to know. We will save that for the plus one for those of you who are members of the Merry Band. If you do want to become a member, we do encourage you to do so. You can sign up. The link is at merefidelity.com. We also would love it if you would rate and review us on iTunes or on your platform of choice. We love reading our mail, so do drop us a line. If you've got a show topic that you'd like us to take up or a guest you want us to talk to, send us a note. We do read that. We're going to be back in the weeks to come. We're putting together plans for the rest of the spring. We don't know what we're doing, but it's going to be great. Until then, though, this has been Mere Fidelity.